Hello, I'm Gail Q. Before I welcome Serge to the microphone, I'd like to set the stage for the listeners because today's interview is unique in more ways than one. Firstly, this interview is not being recorded for radio. It's being done privately. We're recording at the Universal Medicine Clinic in Ganilabaw. It's Sunday, the first day of January 2012, a day many have been waiting for with great anticipation. Serge has graciously, as always, agreed to this interview as a means of giving the students an opportunity to hear him speak about the ageless wisdom in a different setting to the talks, lectures, courses, and workshops that he gives throughout the year around the world. I'm often asked if I discuss the questions with Serge in advance of the interview, and so I take this opportunity to assure you that I don't. We've never discussed questions in advance, and Serge has never given me any direction on what I can or cannot ask. With those introductory comments out of the way, I'd like to welcome Serge.
I'm here. Welcome.
Over the last several years, you've often been interviewed in January, bringing a New Year's message. Now, this year, you've said the New Year's message would follow sometime after the launch of the website. And we're all happy to see the website is launched as of yesterday. I'm aware that much, if not everything, has changed with the arrival of the new era. So even though you haven't yet prepared that message, can you give us a spontaneous one?
The message will be twofold. It'll be a message for the new era and a message for the new year.
Okay.
A new year message is always based on numerology and the science of the numbers that make up that year, which is a presiding energetic impulse that has us for 1 year cycle. But this year is different because we have the new year, or the new era, and that's a new 2,600 year cycle that we are constellated under, and therefore under a certain magnetic pull, and therefore the writing of the message has to coincide with the two. And there has to be a distinction, so there's no conflation, but there needs to be a one and the same message in the fact that they both mean one and the same, at the same time that there has to be a distinction in the message as well.
Okay. Well, I have a little section on numerology later in the interview, so we won't go too far into that, but just to clarify, for the year 2012, would that be under a 5 vibration?
That's correct. All the numbers have to always reduce down to a single digit when you work with numerology.
Mm-hmm.
And even though the numbers that make up, for example, the number 5 are 2 twos and a 1, and they have a bearing, the fact that there's a 2 means that there's a double new beginning. And now there's another 2 that makes up the double new beginning. So there's 2 double new beginnings comprised of the 2 twos.
Mm-hmm.
When you add the 2 twos, they make up the 4, which is foundations. The 1 on its own is the double new beginning, a single new beginning, which is usually a very personal number. So 2012 is an amazing new beginning number, which is absolutely perfect when you look at the signs of esoteric numerology. When they add 5, the number 5 is concrete science and knowledge. The concrete science and knowledge is founded upon the ageless wisdom, which is the energetic truths and laws that make up cosmic life. And so we are to enter this new era with new science. So it's the launch of the new science. So the 2 twos represent humanity and nature, and the 1 is for us to endorse the new era under the new science. And that new science is to launch the fact that energy precedes everything. And whilst we want to look at sugar in a cell, cellular respiration, and everything that makes up biology and all the sciences that we have to look at the fact that there is an energy well before all of this. And if we don't do that, we are going to be left way behind with what is really happening on Earth, as we have been up until this time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that starts to sound like we're going into a more scientific era where things can be more complex. But the simplicity of the message that you've been bringing through for the last few years is so simple. It's the what is, the what is not. Love is, and what is not love. And so that'll still be the basis, even as we go into the more complex scientific aspect of our livingness?
The word complex or complexity only relates to human life. There is no complexity in divinity because everything is known intuitively. So anything you need to know is known at the time that you give it thought. And so there's no need to recall or even store any information. The moment you think of something you need to know, it's already there, known. It's not even something you have to calculate or measure or bring a formula to. Mm-hmm. But the known is given to you in relation to life and not graduated as in how things work. So it's known in an instant in relationship to all life. So if there's anything you want to know, the intuition brings it to you as a complete known that has a relationship with you, the universe, and all life in it in an instance. And so complexity is only for the human being that steps and graduates their mental thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And so science is a progression of learning in 4 or 5 years and getting a PhD, a degree, and so forth. Whereas the intuition brings you the entire package of the science in an instant.
Beautiful. That's very reassuring. Now, with your presentations, the material that you bring forth, how you've been presenting, do you anticipate, foresee a change in that? Or will we continue to have the workshops and the courses and the presentations pretty much as you now established for the student body?
Everything I've been teaching hasn't changed in what I've delivered. What changes is the way I deliver it. And that's adjusted to the energies that we are surrounded by. Now that we've achieved this new era, we're going to be under a certain magnetic pull for the next 50 years. So the first 50 years, another 5, is a very crucial time for us because it's an enormous adjustment that the planet and humanity is going to go under. And I have to feel into the planet, and I have to feel into, intuitively, feel into humanity and adjust the delivery in accordance to how I need to say what I need to say or what humanity needs to hear. And that is a careful, the word is calculation, but it's actually just an impulse that I read into and then just adjust what I need to say. And sometimes it needs to be delivered in a way that exposes the rot or makes somebody feel the irresponsibility, and at other times it'll be to deliver the absolute joy and the love that we have. And that's not something I work out. It's something that is worked out by the people living. So if they come in and they've been getting on with their work, then I just deliver the glory. I deliver the joy. But if they come in measured and not committed, withdrawn, and irresponsible to the things they already need to do, then I need to highlight where they're at, because if I don't, they're not keeping up with where time is.
Mm-hmm.
So the delivery is always based on the impulse of life, not really what Serge decides to do on the day. And that's why I don't prepare for any presentation. I just feel the impulse. And no matter if I have a crowd of 5 or 300 or 450, whoever turns up is representative of all of humanity. I can lecture to just one person, and that will be enough for me to feel where all of humanity is.
Okay, so the reading is always based on the collective of humanity rather than the specific people who've turned up for an event.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, you alluded to the fact some time back that your endorsement of traditional medicine may change in the new era. Do you have a sense of that yet, or can you say anything more about that at this time?
Are you asking in the sense that I'm very pro-conventional medicine?
You have been up till this date. Does that continue?
That continues, but there will be some drugs that I will be very outspoken about, in particular the drugs that numb people and are excessive in the sense of the anti-epileptic type of move that mental health has gone towards.
Okay.
So a little bit, I'll be a little bit more screening of my endorsement of conventional medicine. I'm still very pro-surgery. I'm still very pro a lot of the procedures, excessive as they are today because of the legal medico way in which medicine is practiced today, but I will be a little bit more distinct in the way that I present about pharmaceuticals, because there's quite a few of them that won't make it to what I would call part of what I endorse or the pro-conventional medicine that I used to have a wider umbrella for.
Okay. I'm wondering what changes you feel have occurred or will occur for you personally in the new era. Because, you know, I know you're also part of humanity, but you seem to be operating kind of on a different level than the rest of us. So just wondering if there's any personal changes for you that you feel in the new era that you can share with us.
If I can qualify the question a little further and say, I don't get any special advantages being part of one of the hierarchy who is here incarnated. What I have to do is live just like everybody else and feel the impulses. What gives me an advantage is what I have done for myself as a human being, which has given me the initiations. I don't have any special gifts or anything like that. The intuition I've achieved as a human being, I've achieved it as a human being, mm-hmm. not because I fell to earth and came with all the powers and gifts. So what I've done, I've achieved on my own, as I said, I'm reiterating, but that needs to be understood, because then I'm under the influences and impulses that everybody is in the same way. Only I have the skills that I've built as a human being to cope with them, but those have been built up as a human being. So I still feel everything. I practice everything that I teach. It's just that I have more responsibility and a greater commitment towards them than those who hear it for the first time and are still finding it difficult to apply it into their life. So, for example, I enjoy surfing. But over the years, I've had to change enormously the way I surf, because it doesn't coincide with the energies and in the way in which my soul works. So today I surf very, very gently. You don't go out in the same size waves. You go and you don't stay out there longer and so forth. So these are adjustments that you need to make all the mm-hmm. time. The way you exercise, the way I eat, the number of foods I eat. I've constantly been refined. And these are, in relation to my age, in the sense of the numerology I'm under, which are currently I'm going to be turning 48 in March, which today for me means that I'm under the energy of 3. So I have to live in accordance to a lymphatic year, because the number 3 relates to the lymphatic system. So that relates to everything that I do on a light level. We are already in the new era, so I have to learn to eat and live and walk and exercise and do everything I do, and even my work rate has to adjust to the soulful new era. So all of that needs to be taken into consideration. And these are all the things that I present, but for me they are a livingness. They're not something I hear, it's something that lives. Whereas the students are still hearing it as words, or perhaps some rule, they hear it as rules. Whereas for me they are laws, and they're not laws that you have to fight, they're laws that are part of the livingness. So for me it's just a natural adjustment to live that under an impulse rather than an instruct.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Serge. Well, let's move on to the new website. It's launched. That's always a big relief for everyone who has a new website coming out. Now, it's just barely here, so I've not had much chance to look at it. I'm wondering how hands-on you were with the development of the site. I'm sure the words have come through you. I'm wondering, did you get involved in the design of it?
The design came from a template that already comes with some of the programs that you buy. The majority of the work has been done by Rebecca Baldwin, so hats off to her.
Okay, great.
In addition to her is the background code building and the genius of Scott, who works amazingly behind the scenes, and also to Desiree, who is my personal assistant and who works helps Rebecca on the design. But, you know, I have to say 98% of the wording has come from me mm-hmm. in it, with a few additions of the practitioners adding their own words to their own profiles. But the new website represents an access to universal medicine that we've always had, but it hasn't been a direct public face. If you went onto the old website, that was specifically designed for students, and we did it in a way that screened out those that were looking for something but didn't necessarily... What we didn't want is for people to look for a Band-Aid. We wanted people to be serious. So the website was there to show what we're truly about, and it wasn't everybody's cup of tea, and that was deliberate. But what we didn't have in the last website was all the things that we do, the delivery of the courses and the specialities of our clinics and our dedication to healing and the wonderful practitioners that we've built all over the years. So it's a little bit of a celebration of the people that have been with us. So the website represents all the people that have been with us. And so it shows a universal face to universal medicine. Mm.
And of course, now you've got 10 years of history or more. And so there's an interest in that for newcomers who are coming to universal medicine or to the work. They naturally have a curiosity about, well, where did this come from? How did it get started? And that information now appears on the new website to give them the background. So there's a blue site, you're calling it, and a red site. Now, nothing's by chance with you, so I'm wondering why you've chosen those colors or refer to it in that way.
Well, blue side is the color blue, as in esoteric numerology. There's esoteric colors. The blue is the color of healing, and it has a wide spectrum of blues to cover different types of healing. So we've chosen that particular color because it is the most direct healing and the most universal color of healing. The red side... These are just nicknames and not official names.
Yes.
The red site will then become the earthing site. Red is an earth color, and it's also the color of potential. And so the red site continues to have a direct relationship with the students, whereas the blue site has a direct relationship with the public, mm-hmm. Hence the colors.
Now, will it be, as before, that people can actually join on the website... no fee involved to have access to the student pages, or how is that going to be set up?
There's no fee to join the website, as in access to the red site.
Yeah.
So
okay.
there's a link. You just go on, put your names, establish your own signature, your own login, and you have access to the red site. And we will be putting up lots of public forums, articles, and free meditations, and even this interview will be available on that site. And then there's another site or another part of that red site that has the audio library and the EDG. The EDG costs once in a lifetime $15, which is a donation that goes towards sustaining the websites, which are very expensive to keep in the nature that we build them and keep them. And then the audio is a commitment towards the audio library that you purchase and own. But even though we charge, we've always promoted sharing of the audio. So whilst there is a copyright in the sense that we don't want people to copyright it and bastardize the work, I've never been one to say, I don't want your neighbor listening to it because they haven't purchased it. So we've always, in fact, even said it on our website, we encourage people to share it. Mm-hmm. So it only one household can purchase it. And everybody in that household can share it, as well as all their families and friends. So it really is, I've always been a collective of that audio library purchase.
Well, here we are with the new era, the new website, and also a new book. And it had been a while since a book had been out, at least 2 years, I'm sure. We're still missing the elusive volume 4, I think. So this is actually book 7, although only 6 on the bookshelf. I'm wondering if I offer you a couple of quotes from the new book, can you then expand on them however you feel?
That's easy.
Easy. Okay. Absolute freedom is only found in energetic freedom.
That's a teaching. And then once the person starts to study the words, it becomes a revelation. Once it becomes a revelation, it starts to become a study. Once it becomes a study, it goes back to the teaching. And it will do that 3 or 4 times as a cycle. And I've always said in the past that the esoteric has a 5-dimensional perspective to it. So there will be many, many new meanings as the person goes through that cycle from teaching to revelation to study and back again. So the true meaning of energetic freedom is for you to know the energy that enters you before you are offered a thought. That's the ultimate. To live in a way that you control, for want of a better word, the energy that enters you before you're able to even breathe or think. Now that takes a process, but before you have that process in a living way, it has to be understood, because the human being has been taught to understand things in the mind first. So I write in a way that deconstructs the way in which we've been educated, because that locks you up into thinking that all you need to know or all you do know is in the mind. Whereas I know more than any scientist in my inner heart. In my inner heart I know everything about the universe and how it works. But I may not know the formulas, but everything I know is relative to life. And that is the greatest knowing, because that's what we do, we live. And so there's no point knowing about space if it doesn't relate to life. So intuition is always based on life. So I can answer any question about any mystery in the world, any mystery in the universe. But my answers will always relate to life. And that's how the intuition works.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. All right, here's the next one. We only get affected if we absorb another's condition. Learn to observe, allow, and accept another's choices to play their part.
Once again, once you start doing the process of seeing it as a teaching, and then a revelation, and then it becomes a study when the two start to make a bit more sense, and then it becomes a revelation again, and then a teaching. You'll see that one of the greatest forms of love is to allow time to not relate to how you want things to happen. One of the ways in which we get affected is that we like to see people doing better and not suffering. But that's in relationship to where we are. And that person may need a completely different time to get to that same place. Another person may need more time to get to their glory, to their joy. And what we're doing is we're looking at that person and saying, I'd like you to be in joy right now. Mm-hmm. But we're not giving them the time and space to get to cover all the necessary steps that they need to get to the joy. We want to expedite that joy. But what we learn is that when we do that, it's an imposition, it's a judgment. And by doing that, in other words, by wanting them to be where we want them to be, we recognize that it's a very selfish act, because it's something that is being reflected to us that we don't want to see or feel. And therefore it's related to where you are at. And the imposition is actually very imposing. So what we need to do is look, observe, and have the compassion to let them be and find ourselves in the glory of the fact that they're on their way, in whatever way they need to be. Chosen by their own free will, until such time that there is a different will that they choose.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Good words of advice there.
Yeah, but there's more to it, because if we get involved, that's when we start taking on the poison. It becomes a poison to us, because it's a complete rhythm we're not part of. Somebody else's choices are their own rhythms. We're entering into somebody else's cycle. And to enter into somebody else's cycle, if I just speak of energy, is a vibration you're not part of. And the moment you enter someone else's vibration and your vibration is not part of that same frequency, that's what I call poison. It's an energetic type of poison, which is why we get affected.
Mm-hmm. Yep, very clear. Now, you often say expression is everything. And I'm wondering what your definition of expression is. Is that about words, speaking? What are you implying when you say expression is everything?
In time, people will understand that you only have to move your small finger and the whole cosmos knows about it. So expression is everything means that everything that you do has a bearing in the universe. And we're one of the only few beings that carry what I would call extra limbs. For example, your soul doesn't have arms or legs. And there's not many planets that I know of that have arms or legs. So we have, when we move our elbow, when we bend our elbow, when we move our fingers, we have an enormous impact on life on Earth and also on the cosmos. And one day we will learn that we've become so complicated that we added actually arms and legs. Whereas in other planets, they don't have arms and legs. Mm-hmm. They don't need to eat, and they don't have a mouth, they don't have a stomach. They communicate purely by intuition and impression. So for them, life is super, super simple because it's really just about expression. In other words, just the beingness is enough. And as they move, they understand that they're moving and creating vibrations in the cosmos. So they actually move in the way that they would never disrupt the harmony. Whereas here on Earth, we don't care how we fold our elbows. But one day humanity will understand that folding your elbow creates an enormous impact on the universe.
Okay, we need to look at that in a new way. We've heard you say, eat light to be light, referring to the energy in the foods and not the amount on the plate. In the new era, you say, eat to be love.
Well, the word light and love are one and the same. I've said that in some of my other writings. It's a bit like saying God is light, but you can also say God is love. And you can also say God is love, truth. And you can also say God is joy, God is stillness, and God is harmony. So they all mean one and the same. And the reason why they mean one and the same is because His light is that, all of them equally as one. So when I speak of love, light, truth, harmony, and stillness, I'm speaking all of one meaning, just using a different expression in relation to what the human being needs at that time. So eat light to be light means that you need to understand that you are first and foremost a light being living inside a physical body. And we need to pay respect to that light being, because if we offer a body that is too heavy, the heaviness of the body will be more dominant in a physical world. But if you offer that body a different way of being, then the light being inside it has a better way or a different way with its own carcass to move around on the earth. Mm-hmm. So eat to be love simply means eat to live in a way that you are not causing illness, disease, discomfort, bloating, tiredness, sleepiness, and a lethargic or even heavy body that you have to contend with. And if you contend with a body that you've done that to, there is no way you're ever going to perceive or able to fathom that you are a light being inside it.
Excellent. Okay. A true seer uses smell to look into the future and taste to see the past. When you know what this means, you will be a seer. Well, I'm not sure I know what that means yet. So can you just give us a few more clues? Uses smell to look into the future. Really?
Sense of smell is our ability to feel what's up ahead of us. And the greatest example I've used in the past in my lectures is when we go into autopilot when we're driving, we're actually using a sense of smell. And I started to present that about 7 or 8 years ago. And about 18 months ago, I read a report where they tested drivers in a simulation situation, and they gave them different smells while they were under that simulation driving. Okay. And they noticed that under different smells, they paid more attention to others. And so one day humanity will discover that our senses work on an energetic level much more than they do on a physical level. So our nose is actually used to understand what's ahead of us. And the word taste means that your physical body has endured everything that's ever happened. And that's under the law of group karma. So even though, for example, I've never been raped, let's say, in this life, and I may not have ever been raped in my last life, because I have a physical body and I live on Earth, if I choose to, I can get a taste of what it's like to be raped. And it's not something that I have to imagine in my mind. It's a taste because you can sense the horror, because all of humanity is, some of us in humanity, are carrying that experience. So it's like reading energetically what has happened. And so you get a taste for life, and as a result of getting that taste, you can speak about what is needed to be healed and what is needed to be done for us to be able to go forward. Then you relate going forward to what you feel forward is, in other words, a taste of the future, and then you bring it all back to the present, and that's how I've been able to be so accurate with my predictions.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that happens in an instant. I don't think about it.
Right. Okay, thank you. Now, something you talked about at the New Era workshop and in the early pages of the new book is the concept and reality that we're just going around and around. So I wonder if you could just speak about that briefly for people who maybe have not heard that presentation.
Ask again.
Yeah. Okay. It's about the concept that we're just going around and around.
Okay.
Do it again?
No, I don't. It's the energy in which you ask that is interesting. It's a concept that humanity is, we have been imposed on. When the calendars were made, they were made to suit what people wanted those days to be. For example, I don't want to go into too much detail of the history, but we need to look at history and relate it to life, not just what happens. History has been about an accounting of what's happened. That's usually tied to a date. But what we need to do is look at how life is affected by decisions. For example, the Julian calendar, which was circa Julius Caesar and so forth, which was an adoption of an earlier calendar, and they added 2 months to it to coincide with the solar calendar or the solar year, was basically there to ensure political life and political time and periods. So by adding 2 months, you added actually extra time to a politician's time in office. And we need to look at things like that. Mm-hmm. I know that they're minuscule, but we get imposed by something we think is accurate and based on what the world is doing and physics and physical facts and science, but the energy that calendar came with was not really given to us for us as a humanity. It was imposed upon us so that it could suit the politicians at the time. Likewise, the Gregorian calendar that was then made up by elements of the Catholic Church, they were really just to make sure that the 25th of December coincided with some of their celebrations and so forth. So here we are living under the auspices of these calendars, but they're not really highlighting what we should be learning from a calendar. The original calendars of the Mayans and the Egyptians were based on the cycles, and the cycles automatically tell you that it's a circle and that you understand that you're going around in circles, whereas the Gregorian and the Julian calendar make you look like or make you feel like or make or give you the perception that it's lineal. So when I say to people, what comes up when I say 500 years ago, they immediately think of something that's in the past. But if I draw you an X on a circle and show you that you've crossed that circle 500 times, it gives a completely different perspective when you relate that back to life and you say, if we did something wrong 500 years ago, and you look at it on a line basis, you think, oh wow, that was back then, we must have moved on from now. But if you say, there's an X and we've crossed it 500 times over and over and over, and we are repeating something that isn't good for life, then that brings a totally different way of looking at how we are as human beings. If there was a war 500 years ago, and there are wars today, for example, which there are, what is it about us that we keep returning over and over and over the same mark and not wishing to see?
Well, I understand what you're saying there, and I wonder how we stay optimistic in the light of the fact that we're just going around and around and around and repeating often the same mistakes, making some progress, but where is the upbeat on this? I mean, it's kind of a blessing and a curse all in one. The blessing is we get another chance to do it right this day, but there's kind of a fruitlessness about it, an endlessness that seems like we're never going to get it right.
I'd like to answer that by the old series called Kung Fu, and I would say, little grasshopper, you are so narrow-minded, if we can be playful. But if you understand that we're going round and around, the optimism is that we are given an enormous amount of love to get it right. The optimism, if we can use that word, is God's great love, that we can go round and around and around until we get it right. And then if we look at that and examine that fact that we go round and round until we get it right, and looked upon it from that point of view, then you bring in the science of reincarnation, it makes enormous amount of sense for us to go round and round and round, life after life after life, not going anywhere, until we do get it right, and then we realize that we are going somewhere, only that it's not on a on the plane of life that we're going around and around in, but up. In other words, back to where we come from. So evolution is actually up, not forward.
Mm-hmm. Now, say we've spent lifetimes not getting it right. We've made mistakes, we've hurt people, we've not been self-loving, whatever the case is. And then in this lifetime, we actually start to wake up. We change our behavior. We become more self-loving. We become more of service to others. Is that enough to progress us upward and onward, or do we still have to come back, maybe in the next lifetime, and make amends to those people that we hurt, or to relive that experience of not loving ourselves?
The greatest way to make amends or heal the past is by living in the moment with love, because everything you've done is an energetic connection, has an energetic connection to you. They are imprints or bits of braille stored in energetic writings that you've left as an impress on this plane of life that we live. What we're here to get right is the plane of life we entered into, that we actually created as spirits, not all of us, but most of us created. And therefore we have to heal that imprint that we created in this universe that was never designed to hold such an imprint. But because we have free will, we're able to do it, and we've done it, and here we are living it. But we're living in a way that is completely incongruent to the way in the way the universe works. So we have to clear up all these imprints, and that's why we go round and round in a circle, in our own circle, in our own plane of life, in our own dimension, until we clear it all up. And then what we're going to do is actually leave this dimension and go back and rejoin the universe in the way it actually works, because we actually live in separation to the universe, even though we are still connected and are still under its constellated laws.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so just back to that point, though, do we need to make... So we're needing to correct that imprint that we've created in past behavior. So we can do that in this lifetime in a forward way. That means we don't have to go back necessarily and face up with that person or that repeat that situation. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
Okay.
And if I can elaborate here, in the past, we, in our first incarnation, which was what we would call six cycles ago, or the correct terminology is six root races ago, we never had the capacity to erase our imprints, because we had to basically live in the mesh of what we created. Life was very harsh. Life was very awful, if we can say it like that, very hard. Since then, each and every cycle, God gives us a blessing, and that blessing is to accelerate our ability to heal, our ability to erase the past. In other words, it's an acceleration to clear up this plane of life and then go back to where we come from. This, to cut a long story short, this cycle that we're in right now is 10 times greater than any other. And so anybody who is committed to living the soulful life will clear the past faster than any other root race that we've ever been involved with. So if you go back to the word you introduced, which was optimism, we have an enormous optimism towards this new era, because we can clear more than any other time and faster than any other time. So it's a bit like if you develop a great relationship with one person and then you extend that to the next person and then to the next person, you never have to revisit everybody that you've ever not had a harmonious relationship with. It gets cleared by virtue of the fact that the energetic imprint you have with that person is restored to the livingness that you are today. And they feel that magic. And the beautiful thing is they are also released from the former imprint that held you guys together, which was disharmonious.
Oh, beautiful.
It's getting better and better.
Great. Now, just an earlier reference to the Mayan calendar, which is, of course, what 2012 has been linked to for eons. Looking back to that time when the Mayans were creating their calendar and it ended at this point, what was it that they were seeing in the energetic imprints that would cause them to stop creating a calendar at this point?
If we look at the past, we will see that our ancient knowledge was based on cycles. And one of the greatest problems we have with modern scholars is that they get terrified of looking at the past and seeing that they actually know more than we know today about lots of things. And they get terrified at discovering that, and a lot of pride and arrogance kicks in when they can see that without telescopes, the Mayans had enormous accuracy, as did the Egyptians. So how did they have such great accuracy in regards to astrology and astronomy and mathematics, particularly with angles, when they didn't have universities, when they didn't have PhD professors? Where was all this information coming from? So that needs to be said in relation to the question that you ask. Secondly, the Mayans, the actual calculation of the Mayans, according to a lot of people, is actually December 21, 2012, which is where they actually end their cycle. But the Mayans didn't allow for the speeding up of the precessional axis that we count the zodiacal signs. So that date is actually brought forward to the time that it is right now. Another factor that is not considered is that even though we do align to the laws of constellation, numerology has also an important part to play. And so the numerology of 2012 and the first day of 2012 brings it to light today. And that has also a bearing in the cycle. So the cycles aren't just a number that you calculate based on a constellation in relation to where that star is and the Earth and so forth, its relationship to the Sun. There's a numerological explanation to that as well. So today we are 2012. It's the brand new era. The last era was a cycle of 2015 years, and this one is a cycle of 2600 years. The reason that the cycles change is just the relationship of how long we hold our relationship to the zodiacal alignment. So this particular alignment is going to be a little bit longer than the last one. So when we look at cycles and relate that back to the fact that we're going around in circles and coming back to the same time, we have a different and a new way of looking at life. It's not just the X that we're crossing 500 times or 1,000 times, but we're looking at a cycle of offering under a constellation. So we're going, so the way to look at it is like this, if I can make it simple for our listeners. We go around an X and say we've been around that 500 times. Firstly, you've got to say that wasn't 500 years ago. That's 500 times we've crossed this X. Then what we'd look at is 500 times around this X under the constellation that we are in. So what does this cycle mean, and how are we living 500 times over and over and over within this cycle? Now, if this cycle meant love, or say the embodiment of love as in Christ, which was the last cycle, the embodiment of Christ in the body, which was the Antikarana, and we look at the fact that we still don't embody Christ or the light of the soul, and we've gone around 2015 times around that X, and at the end of that, not only have we gone around the same spot, around and around in circles, and we still haven't adopted what the cycle has offered, it shows you how far behind mankind is. And now we're entering into a new cycle that is not saying it's about embodiment, but it's now about the fact of living the light that is already here. It's not even embodied, it's grounded. We walk upon it. It's a small command and we embody it. And yet most people are still not living the fact that we can embody it. And so we are now under a new cycle that will have to have a lot of adjustments for us to be able to cope with it. What the Mayans found, that at the end of every cycle and at the beginning of every new cycle, there was cataclysm. And cataclysm meant adjustments, that the world needed to adjust, the planet nature and the human race to adjust to be able to cope with a new cycle in addition to the fact that we count years. And that's what it's really all about. I'm trying to keep it simple here for the purpose of this
interview.
Well,
that was a good summary, and I think simple enough. I got what you're saying. Thank
you
for sharing
that. It's an enormous science if we want to sit down and talk about it. And maybe one day I'll release a little bit more about it. But not only is it 2012, a new year, a new birthday to contend, but an absolute new cycle we are under that we need to pay attention to. If not, we will be made to pay attention to.
Right. Got that. Okay, well, let's just take numerology right at this spot, since we've referenced it again. And I know really very, very little about esoteric numerology. It seems the primary number in esoteric numerology is your, for us as humans, is the age that we are at any given time. Is that correct?
That's correct, because that teaches you the cycle that you're in as you are going around the planet,
okay.
Or around the sun, I should say.
Now, you said you're going to be 48 in March, and you're already then in a 3 vibration, because it starts sometime before your actual birthday then.
2 months before the month you turned, or the birth date.
Okay, 2 months before the month in which you turn the new age.
Correct.
All right. How about just giving us a brief summary on the 1 through 9 vibrations? In esoteric numerology, do they set 11, 22, and 33 off as esoteric vibrations of their own that are not to be factored down to a single digit? Or is it just the 1 through 9?
It's 1 through 9.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you give us a few words or a couple of sentences on each one of those vibrations, starting with 1?
Yes, I can generalize. 1 is a new beginning. That is, I think, under many numerological interpretations.
Mm-hmm.
2 is a double new beginning that can also be used as 2 ones. And those 2 ones can relate to 2 different parts of your life. So a person can have, for example, a new career and a new relationship. They don't necessarily, or a new way of being in a family. 3 is the year of light. This is where we need to look at our overall way of being, how we are with the world, how we allow the world back to be back with us. 4 is foundations. We need to look at where we stand, what we stand on. We need to challenge ideals and beliefs that we think are right, and we need to relate those to the way we actually live, and then challenge them if they don't fit into joy, truth, harmony, stillness, and love. 5 is concrete science and knowledge again. And concrete science and knowledge is about relating to what you know and how you understand life to be, and making sure that what you learn is actually helping you live truly and not necessarily better or to help you manage your way through life. 6 is about love. Your relationship with yourself deeply, how deep you can love yourself, and also how deeply you can love others. And the relationship of love per se is a humanity, holding everybody equally, yet allowing everybody to just be under their own rhythm and progression. 7 is one of the numbers of the body. 7 relates to the physical human body, and it relates to how we are in digestion, how we are in physical shape, how we are in physiology, anatomy, structure, and so forth. 8 is what we call the heavenly number. It's your relationship to your soul. It's your ability to connect to the fact that you come from divinity. It's your ability to look back at the human being and say, I get you're human. I get there's a reality. I can't deny that. I can feel it, touch it, sense it, smell it, and so forth. But that we do come from something greater, and that our path on earth is actually to return to that greatness that we are already and once were. And 9 is about ending cycles. 9 is about ending everything that doesn't work, everything that doesn't relate to being divine. And so it's also being called the number of the beast. And the number of the beast, the word beast means the spirit, the aspect that's separated from the soul, to become beastly, in other words, to become human, to join the animal kingdom, to derive its new body from the animal kingdom, and to make itself a carcass or an incarnation, so to speak. So 9 is the actual number of the beast. If you use the word, the numbers 666, which has been accorded to the devil and Satan and so forth, and you understand the laws of numerology, and you add 3 sixes, 18. They come to 18. If you add 1 and 8, that comes to 9.
Right.
So it is in fact the number of the beast. But you need to understand what the beast means. And the beast is simply that, the wayward aspect that separated from soul and lost its way, so much so that it even created for itself a beastly body, in other words, an animal. And in that it's and in that existence, the beast or the spirit has been lost ever since. And so life on earth is actually about the ending of that cycle, the ending of separation with soul. So we, planet Earth, is actually a 9 cycle. It's about actually finishing the life of the spirit in separation.
Now, why are you saying that Earth is the 9 cycle?
It's a 9 cycle because we were not ever supposed to enter Earth, the Earth realm, as a living quarter, as a living realm. That was the spirit that decided from the etheric plane to enter the physical life. Whereas on the astral plane, that cycle is an 8, because it's about the spirit returning to soul. But the spirit descended further and went into the beastly body, and therefore we are here to arrest the beastly body.
Okay. Well, thanks for that summary. I want to keep talking about numbers for a minute, but I want to put a dollar sign in front of them, which gives them a slightly different spin. Now, last year at one of the EDGs, you brought up a topic that really seemed to engage the student body, and that was about the dollars involved in, say, paying for a place to live. Whether you own your own home or you rent a home, and by owning your own home, we're assuming that you're paying a mortgage somewhere to a bank. So people became very concerned about the implications of that money that they were paying out into the world. So I guess we need to just establish the energy of money first before we kind of get into this a little bit. Can you talk about, you know, money makes the world go round and money is the root of all evil, and what do you want to say about money to set the stage for a couple of money questions?
Well, money is not the root of all evil. There's a lot of great good that we can do with money. It's the person wielding the money that makes what we would call evil with it or good with it. So money itself just sits on the shelf. It sits in the bank or sits on a table. It doesn't do anything. It cannot do any evil. It's only evil when I hold it and do something with it. Therefore, the root of all evil is the consciousness that we use outside of the divine. Money itself can buy lots of great good, and it can also destroy and help and crush and manipulate and impose and war. It can buy weapons, it can buy war and so forth. So it's not the money itself. We tend to blame money. The consciousness of blaming money means that it means to be good. In order to be good, you have to be poor. And it's not about that. That's a lie we've been spun, that, you know, you have to be poor or give away free if you free goodies or free healing if you're part of divinity, and that only those that charge are evil, so to speak. But we live in a world where, unfortunately, it's a trading commodity, and you can't make things happen without money. So there's a divine part of money too. Because money represents kidney energy, in other words, life force. And how we use money represents how we live or can live. It represents what we are going to live like, and it represents what we can live like in the future. So it's an enormous responsibility knowing the true power of money, and not just to use it as a force, whether you have it or you don't.
So if a person is living to the best of their ability, an esoteric life, trying to be, are being soulful, and they are paying rent to a landlord, let's say, who's alcoholic or a drug dealer or somebody who's not love, is there an implication back to the person who has given that money to the person who's not using it for love?
First and foremost, the power of love, if I may use such a term, or the energy of fire, which is the real definition, always has much more power than prana. So if I live in a rented home where the landlord is a pimp or a drug lord, I get affected by that energy so long as I don't live who I truly am. And I will be influenced by that energy, and I will be affected, my kids will get affected and so forth, but because I'm living in something that is owned under the energetic dominance of that person who owns it. However, if I live me inside that home, even though I don't own it, I actually own my living space. I don't have to own the walls or the mortgage or the title. The moment I start to live me, I create an energy in that place. And the moment I live esoterically in that place, or live from my inner heart, then the landlord starts to get the energy of love. Mm. And therefore we are giving them a healing impress, or healing. So whether we pay mortgage as I do, the bank gets a blessing from the way I live. So when I pay my mortgage, the bank receives that energy in the way that I live from my soul. If I was paying rent, it's the same thing. The rental money goes towards the real estate agent, it goes through their hands and then back to the landlord. Well, they're getting a blessing from the way I live in that home. If I wasn't living me and I was part of the pranic world, even though I may not be a drug addict or a drug peddler, because I'm pranic, I still get affected by the prana.
Uh-huh.
Whereas if you're in fire, you affect it, you affect the prana.
Okay, great. Really clear. Now, speaking of paying mortgages to the bank, are banks, can you generalize that banks are a pranic energy or a fiery energy?
Banks are just a system, and depending on who's running them, the energy can change. I did a prediction, I did a reading on some financiers in England some time back, and every one of those banks that I said were clear are the ones that didn't get affected by the financial crisis.
Oh, okay.
And I wasn't basing my information on their assets and what they held in value and real money asset and real money in the bank and so forth. I based it on the energy I was feeling from the bank, and that's basically based on the people who are running it, and that's
down to the individuals.
Down to the individuals.
Okay.
It's like the energy of a school is first and foremost governed by the principal, and then the teachers either align to that principal, and then it becomes one energy governed by the principal. But if the energy, if the teachers start to say, well, no, his or her ways are not loving, or his and her ways are not harmonious, and they start to implement more harmonious ways, and it won't be one energy that's ruling the whole school. And so it's likewise in the bank. If we get a lot of tellers, for example, wanting to meet their clients and share a harmonious way of being every time they come in to do a transaction, then irrespective of the corruption, if I may use that word, or greed at the top level, that bank will have generally a very good energy.
Mm.
Or more likely to have a good energy.
Okay.
But there's certainly there are new policies in certain banks that are making them distinguishably much easier to deal with and much lighter to transact with.
And here in Australia, is there a bank particular that is more fire than others?
I don't know if this is the right forum to name them, but definitely I can think of at least four banks that I would have no issues in banking with. But what I can say is I bank with Westpac.
Oh, thank you. That's a big tip.
In particular, the Lismore branch, which is, they know what we do. They know all about our work. And I believe some of the students are there also.
Uh-huh. Okay. Couple more money questions. And then I'm realizing we've been probably close to an hour here at the interview. So we'll have to start thinking about wrapping up, but about inheriting money. Now, if you inherit money from somebody and that money has been earned in questionable ways, possibly illegal ways, or just in practices that weren't healthy for humanity, when you receive that inheritance, does it come loaded with an energy that you're then burdened by?
It comes loaded with an energy, and that energy is going to be pranic if it hasn't been used for truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean whether it's illegal or not. If it's been used to hoard, if it's been used to accumulate wealth for somebody to identify themselves by, that is no different to somebody selling weapons and so forth. It's still pranic. It's all under the one pranic umbrella. We've got to be careful, because if we're living a pranic life and we're given money, all we're going to do is better that life. But that life isn't about becoming soulful or returning to soul. We're looking at that money as a human being and what it can buy for us as a human being. And most people use that money to better their lifestyle. But that often buries them deeper and makes them more wayward in a way, because money can sometimes, money can buy yourself out of a suffering and out of a lesson that you are otherwise there to learn. So it does come loaded energetically, and we've got to be very, very careful.
Is there a way to clear that?
There's a way to clear it, but ultimately there's a way to clear it in the sense that you receive the money, you put it in the bank, you put it under a symbol, you put the statement or the letter that refers to that bank account on a symbol, you clear it for 3 months, and then that will clear the money most of the time.
Okay.
But ultimately it's how you live, because then you receive that money cleared and you are its new energetic imprinter, if I can say it like that. Mm-hmm. You will re-imprint the cause of that money.
Great. Now, inheritance, just kind of the next step down, say that you're a person of not immense wealth, but moderate or whatever. Let's say you've got $300,000 and you die, and the people that get that money by your direction, the beneficiaries of your will, if they go and spend that money in ill ways, on drugs or alcohol or to build a church or whatever it might be, is there an implication back to the person who gave that money? Even though that body's passed on, is there a repercussion if that money is ill spent?
If you're able to rewind how I finished off the last part of our discussion, you'll see that it ends with an unmentioned word, and that's responsibility. You are the re-imprintor of that money. Mm-hmm. In other words, you will re-imprint everything you do from then there forward with that
right. Cleared
money. So it comes down to responsibility. Now, when it comes to leaving money behind, it once again is responsibility. And it shouldn't be in an ideal or a belief or a feeling sorry for someone, or you know, the usual ideal of leaving it to your blood family or your children and so forth. If you can see that a child of yours is wrecking their life and you're going to give them $250,000 or whatever it is as a portion of the inheritance, well, you're buying them a guaranteed way of not getting back to soul. If they're not able to use that constructively and positively in a way that actually brings them back to who they truly are, but instead buys them more holidays, a grander home, perhaps a greater wine collection and so forth, you've actually added to somebody's separation to their soul. If we're here to end the cycle, if we're here to return to soul, then we've got to be very careful when we come in, when we introduce the word karma, about what we do with money. And when you pass over, it doesn't end when you reincarnate and they are still using what you left behind for them to continue to use, affects you in your next life.
Mm-hmm.
And that science is simple, because it's based on energetic imprints. We are bound by this realm we live in, and it's a bit like living underwater, and it's a bit like saying, if I may say it, you urinate and you can't escape from the fact that you've re-urinated. And so that urine will be everywhere in the water. You have to be responsible about everything that we do, because we're living in energy. And we can't just urinate because we want to, because somebody else is going to swim through that. And why should they be able to? Why should they have to swim through that when you did what you did in this energy that we're living in?
Right. Now, you mentioned putting the bank statement on a symbol, a clearing symbol.
Extractor one.
Extractor one, okay. I just wanted to talk about the personal healing symbols very briefly. There's quite a few of them. And in the past, again, like many things with UniMed, it's not in your face. You have to kind of really go after it. You have to find them. They're not on the homepage, so to speak. And so, in fact, it's even on a different, separate website, isn't it, the healing symbols?
They're not part of the new website.
Okay. So people will, they're still available. People
still
just
available.
Have to seek them out.
Correct.
Okay. Now, I wanted to speak specifically about the pendants that so many esoteric students wear. I've recently heard that in Vietnam, because you hold retreats there annually, the Vietnamese refer to the esoteric students as the necklace people. Now, you wear a personal pendant?
Yes, I do.
Okay. I was assuming yours was the first, probably.
I had mine before anybody else's, and I had no intention of ever having anybody else own one. It was basically it was Desiree who made me aware that I can't keep doing all these things that I'm doing for me only and not be able to share this science with everybody else. And that's something that I would have eventually realized, but I was very hesitant in being a teacher that is labeled with producing products and making money and, you know, like selling photos of my feet and things like that, as a lot of the gurus do. But it is a science, and I was practicing that with myself and with my children in order to help us. And I was doing hand-drawn symbols back then to help us as well. So it was Desiree who said, we need to have this for everybody. You can't just have it for yourself. And I knew that. And eventually I had to put it out, because it's not something I can use for myself and not everybody else equally. Otherwise that would be a karma. So we ended up producing them. Now, the symbol that is worn around our neck doesn't have to be worn around our neck. That's something that people have found that they would like to do. But we need to go back to ancient times, and we need to recognize that we always had symbols that represented something from divinity. We're living in a realm that is physical, and we wanted a connection with that. And whilst we can have a pure energetic connection, and that's all you need, because you never need anything, we need to understand that because we're still in a physical body, it's sometimes nice to have something you can feel represents in the physical world something you know and can feel comes from the divine. So the original symbols that we had on earth were all divine, until such time that humanity started to bastardize them and start using other symbols. For example, we can talk about the cross as used by the Christian church. I mean, that's the Roman symbol of torture and death, and which we wear around our neck. That's not something I would like to wear. Now, they will argue that it's a symbol of Jesus Christ dying on the cross for our sins and resurrecting. Mm. But that's an argument based on what they believe. The fact is that symbol was where people got tortured and died. And if we said that when Jesus was crucified, and there was never any more crucifixions thereafter, maybe we could wear it in celebration of the fact that he was the last to die, and therefore it ended crucifixion or that form of horror that we had in humanity. But the fact that it continued for quite a few number of years, tens of years well after, means that we're celebrating something that the Romans came up with. It was never a Christian thing. It was never the Christ who said, I represent the cross. Never in his words did he say that. So we've got to understand that a symbol has to represent something we know is divine. What we know is divine is not something that you're told in your head or taught as a child to understand or accept. It's something you can feel. And once you can feel it and it becomes real as in the feeling, then it's okay to have a physical representation of that. Because the knowing isn't in the physical symbol, it's actually in the energy. And it's a way of celebrating that by having it in the physical.
Mm-hmm. So for people who choose to wear it as a necklace, are they benefited in any way by wearing it?
They're benefited by the gesture of the fact that they're making a claim that as a human being, they are also willing to be represented by a form of divinity they have already felt into was divine. There's no point getting a symbol and wearing it because somebody else has, because then it's just an icon. It needs to be something you feel you would like to have. And once you receive it, you say, yeah, that feels right, that feels clear, that feels true. I will now get a pendant.
Would there ever be an occasion where it wouldn't be appropriate for someone to have one? Would you ever decline to give somebody one if they...
There's lots of people who've declined having one because I felt that they were just getting it because it was something that they wanted because everybody else had one.
And, okay.
And there are a few people that I've said, you're not ready for one, and come back another time.
Okay. Well, I think we do have to head into a wrap-up on the interview, but I wanted to throw you a couple of lighter topics. Again, I'll give you a word, and you just give us a couple of sentences on it.
If I can.
Okay. Pinocchio.
We need to look at what on earth is true or not, and some of our cartoons and stories give off an esoteric help in life. Pinocchio is one such story that helps us, and even though it's not what it appears to be, there's a great message in Pinocchio.
Okay.
In about responsibility.
Well, I saw Pinocchio sitting on top of a bookshelf here in the clinic, and he kind of stands out as a unique fictional character in the clinic. I wondered what the alignment there was. What about a piano?
What about a piano?
I'm wanting you to say it's your favorite instrument.
It is definitely one of my favorite instruments.
I thought it was.
Probably the most famous. Although it's close to percussion. I love percussion because the piano is very physiological and percussion is very anatomical in the sense that it directly involves the physical, the muscles and the bones and the structure of the body. All musical instruments can be played under the impulse of your soul, and therefore it can produce a sound that is divine. Having said that, there are some musical instruments or objects that have been made to create sound that are not able to be used by the soul, and I won't name them on this interview, because I've said them in lectures when people are ready to understand, and there's too much lead up for me to name them. And
yes, understood.
Just to name them. But the piano can be played under the impulse of the soul, and it can sound heavenly, or it can be played by fingers that learn to play the piano to please mum and dad, or to find recognition, or to find self in it. And when those notes are produced, those notes might be mathematically correct, but energetically they still carry the individualism of the person. Whereas in the past, particularly in Persia and in Egypt, we learned to play an instrument so that we could serve humanity, so that we could serve the need to heal. It was never something you did for yourself, to bury your anger or to hide yourself in a bedroom and play away, or to play songs that help you bury your issues that you don't want to deal with or bring up emotions for you. So not everybody chose to play an instrument. You chose it in the same way that you would choose, I want to do chakra puncture because I want to help people. So it was a totally different meaning to wanting to play an instrument, because it was for only healing purposes, and never ever was it for self to hear how you could play or hear even your own music. It was to produce music that other people needed to hear rather than yourself.
Mm-hmm. What about diamonds, which are promoted and sold as the great symbol of love? What's your reading on diamonds?
Well, obviously the diamond thing with blood diamonds and so forth has to be contended with. But there's a way of celebrating the beauty that is on earth. If it's something that is celebrated as a look at what I've got or look at what I can afford, then obviously it's an individual thing that comes with a pranic thing. But if it's something that can be celebrated in the sense that you wear it to denote an occasion, and it only means that occasion, and that occasion is celebrated in truth, then it's not a bad thing to have. You've heard me say that there's no energy or power in stones. It's only what we do with them and because of them that makes the energy. So It's the same as gold. Gold is a symbol of God's light. And wearing gold in the past was a recognition that you were aligned to deity, that you understood that there was a higher power. That's what gold meant in the past. So it wasn't that the people adored gold as a trading commodity. It was that they adored gold, meaning that they respected that they weren't human, that there was actually more, that there was a greater power. And that ornament or that color represented that. But it wasn't the fact that it was something that was more valuable than anything else. Mm-hmm. The value was in the recognition of what it represented, more than the stone itself.
Thank you, Suraj, and thank you for your time today. Just in closing the interview, you've said that 2012 is about truth, love, harmony, stillness, and joy. Is one of those more favorite for you than any others?
As I said earlier in the interview, they all mean one and the same. They are the light of God. They're actually called the five elements of God from an esoteric point of view. I was going to say something else, but I won't.
Okay.
We don't have time. Yes, we won't have time. But the five elements of God are representative as one and all meaning the same. But each and every one of us as a human being needs to find that one that helps trigger the others, or that one that you feel most associated with, or the one that means to you the most. For a lot of people, harmony is everything. For a lot of people, joy is everything. For some people, it's truth. And once you find that, once you connect to truth, you know you're in love, in joy, in harmony, and stillness. For some people, it is stillness. And once they have that stillness, they know they are truthful. They know there is love. For others, it will be love. So we need to find a way, one of those elements that actually triggers all the other four. Mm-hmm. And when you connect to that one, you recognize that the other four are all the same.
Thank you, Suraj. Here's to a joyful 2012 for all of us.
Here's to the next 2,600 years.
Yay.
Thank you.